the show.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of The Boundless Show. We're here in the studio with Steve and Suzanne and Mott and myself. Hi, everyone.
Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Lisa.
Hey, well, we're going to talk about the Oscars today, and the Oscars are coming up, and so we're going to give our completely uneducated Oscar roundup for all of you this time around.
Incomplete.
Exactly. We're going to kick it off with that, and then later on, we're going to have a culture segment with Jay Richards of the Acton Institute talking about stewardship, biblical stewardship of resources and beyond, what that looks like, and then wrap it up with our inbox segment on starting a family, and should the woman just give up her career and stay home and throw on an apron. So we'll talk about that. Steve's going to address it. Whoa, chauvinistic. We'll see what he has to say. So, but let's get back to the Oscars. We were talking previous here about how sad it is that we actually had to give a shout out to actually go see some of these films prior to talking about them because we hadn't seen any of the actual Best Picture contenders. Mm-hmm. At this point, between the four of us, we have seen a grand total of two of the
yes.
Best Picture. Suzanne having seen both of these two, and the rest of us having seen Slumdog Millionaire.
Yeah, and that was only yesterday.
Yeah, we left like during the workday to go see it. So, and it was funny. I walked into the theater and I was like, why are there so many people here? And why is there a line and stuff? I thought I'd just be sitting by myself. And the theater was quite packed, and I guess President's Day played into that. But,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, so...
You know, I want to share my experience yesterday going to a theater here in town. Both the popcorn guy and the guy who took my ticket wanted to tell me something about the movie I was going to see. I don't know if that's new or if you guys are experiencing that now, but they're like, oh, Slumdog, yeah, that's a great movie. Now, there's some rough parts to it. And again, the ticket guy said the same thing. Oh, yeah, I want to warn you, though, there's some hard stuff in there. Hey, thanks, ticket guy.
You wow. think Ticket Guy's been reading Plugged In online?
Maybe.
Yeah, I was
know.
Like, were you wearing your Focus on the Family
I wasn't.
Badge?
But I appreciated it.
That is good, yeah. Well, it did, you know, it was definitely a departure from the Bollywood films that I'm used to watching that come out of India. So it was no Pride and Prejudice.
Do you watch a lot of Bollywood films?
Oh, I do, yeah. I just love the singing and dancing and colorful sets.
There was a touch of Bollywood at the end of
there
the
was.
Movie.
Could
yeah.
you explain Bollywood? I'm not familiar.
Oh,
that.
Well, it's kind of like it's the movie industry
out of India.
Yeah, out of India. Actually, I think it is Mumbai is like the old,
so.
Yeah, is where they're all produced. And
they're actually producing some Adventures in Odyssey stuff these days.
Oh, that's
aren't they
true.
All very yeah, clean and like they're produced? Very, watching a clear play movie?
Yeah, they're generally very clean. Like they can't, most of them, they won't, like, no one will kiss in it because that's like a, you know, would be against a Hindi kind of strictures and whatnot. So,
but they burst into celebratory song and dance mm-hmm. quite often.
Yeah.
And I'm a musical theater fan, but when I went to see Pride and Prejudice, I didn't know that was a Bollywood movie. I knew nothing
oh,
about
yeah.
Bollywood. And the first time they started singing and dancing.
Yeah.
I had a hard time keeping it together.
Yeah, it's even worse than like your standard musical where people will start singing and you're like, oh, here's a nice song and stuff. This is like way out of nowhere and it's always some super cheeseball stuff.
Overly
like,
dramatic.
Like on the beach when yeah. the choir's there. Yeah, that was a
sorry
bit
if
much.
You love Bollywood.
But it's a good time. It's fun. So, and I think Aishwarya Rai is just one of the prettiest people in the world. That's just my own plug for her. Hey. I think this is interesting because I actually sent out an email to a couple of my friends, two guys who are movie connoisseurs, and they get very excited about the Oscars and they watch a lot of the films that are up and they, you know, are part of groups that just dissect them and whatnot. So I asked for any thoughts that they'd have had, and interestingly, one of them got back to me and said that the only one that he had seen was Slumdog Millionaire of all of them. And I was pretty surprised by that because we have... the others, at least for Best Picture, being The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, Frost Nixon, Milk, The Reader, and Slumdog Millionaire. And I don't know, those of you who saw, I mean, it kind of runs the gamut as far as, you know, topical material here and kind of what happens in each one of these, several of them being based on real, actual factual historical events. So that's pretty interesting. But what did you guys think as far as seeing a representative then of this film, like Slumdog? What did you think about the film? Is it an Oscar contender?
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, it's that kind of movie that stays with you. It's different, just the way it's shot. You know, with the guy on the game show, sort of playing his life back, and how he was able to answer all the questions, or who wants to be a millionaire. You know, it's hard to say. I don't see a lot of movies. I haven't seen any of the other movies. But yeah, I thought it was very well done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think it was well crafted. It was telling a story in a way that you weren't expecting. It revealed a lot about the culture of growing up in the slums in a kind of a disarming way. And so it hit you, but it wasn't overdone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but you know, the interesting thing about which movies get the Oscar nod for nominee is that there are a lot of years where the movies that sell a ton of tickets aren't necessarily the ones that get the attention of the Academy, because they don't necessarily have a creative approach. It's just a good popcorn flick. I mean, you know, a National Treasure type movie that everybody enjoys, and you walk out of the theater feeling on top of the world. But it's not going to get an Oscar nod, and that kind of happened with The Lord of the Rings. It wasn't until the last of the trilogy that, you know, it somehow combined the popularity of the film with what the Academy gets excited about. And I think because of that, sometimes we scratch our head and say, well, I haven't seen any of those movies. You know, why did they get nominated? Unfortunately, a lot of times it's because they have an agenda. I mean, this Milk movie, I mean, yeah, it's got some creative touches and all, but you just have to wonder how much it has more to do with the agenda of the Academy. Would they have put up a similarly well-produced movie if it was about some breakthrough evangelical candidate? I don't think so.
Yeah. And even Frost Nixon, too, is probably an agenda-driven movie.
Yeah. I mean, how often is that the case, where they totally ignore the movies that actually got people to go to the theater and see the movie and tell all their friends about it, because it really just did great storytelling, great movie, but it just didn't fit the agenda of the Academy? That's why I think it's interesting that there are so many other award shows these days. You know, People's Choice and the Golden Globes, and even, you know, I know just a couple of days ago there was a John Templeton Foundation event where they honored all these faith-based films, and not all of them were the movies that are created in the faith community. Some of them were the mainstream movies, but they happen to carry a stronger faith message than some of the other ones that seem to be promoting an anti-faith message.
Mm-hmm. Well, and going along with that, a couple years ago I went to a Christianity and Culture conference at Colorado Christian University, and Tony Jones, who
it's
is
a lot of alliteration.
Yes. Tony Jones, who's kind of an expert on faith and culture, came in and he told us, you should watch every Oscar nominated film because it's going to tell you something about culture. And at the time, I remember one of the nominees was Crash, you know, and he was saying, this tells you about racism in America and how people are feeling about this issue. But speaking to what Steve is saying, is it really the culture that you're seeing in those picks, or is it the Academy?
Yeah. It's like Hollywood is culture. Is that what he's saying? That whatever Hollywood produces, it represents our culture?
And,
I don't know.
And obviously we should be aware and engaged, but how much mud should we drag ourselves through? I mean, do we need to play every popular video game? Do we need to watch every popular television show? How deep do you have to go? And I think, to be honest, the reason why a lot of people find themselves saying, there's a lot of stuff nominated that I never saw, is because more and more we're just choosing not to pay the big bucks to go see it at the theater. We're reserving some of these for when they come out on DVD and we can watch them at home and on our own terms. And even a lot of people who are waiting and saying, I'm going to watch this on my ClearPlay DVD or some other device that filters out the bad stuff so that they can get the meaning and some of the best parts of the movie without having to be exposed to 5,000 F-bombs and gratuitous nudity and unnecessary violence and other things that come with it.
Yeah, I go to so few movies. I do wait to go to the sort of the event movies,
yeah.
Like Batman. We went to see Batman, and we went to see Prince Caspian. I think those are the only two movies that we went to see in 2008 in the theater. Oh, in Fireproof, but that was a different that was a preview, and that was free, so that was great. But all the other ones I save for DVD or just to watch at home.
Mm-hmm. Well, and don't you think there's a certain element of a snobbery when it comes to the Oscars, where, you know, these films don't tend to win at the box office because a lot of people don't want to go and pay $8.50 to just hear hard things. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you look at some of these Best Picture nominees, and they're, like I said before, they're accounts of historic events that, you know, a lot of people, they want to go and you know, so the reason I haven't seen some of these is that one of them isn't Beverly Hills Chihuahua, I mean, which is, you know, some of the
I was
the
waiting
fair,
for that to come up
is the fair that I saw in 2008. And but, you know, I mean, I read the news, and it's like, you know, the racism argument, you know, I could go ask my black friend what racism is like in America. I don't need to see some artistic interpretation of that. But at the same time, I think it's interesting. I was reading how, you know, we kind of get it from both sides, because we often feel like evangelicals and those of a, you know, Judeo-Christian bent are underrepresented in the movie theater. But I know the gay community was very angry about Brokeback not getting the nod. They always feel they're nominated, but then they never get it. So they're always just getting these concessions.
Like the Susan Lucci of the Oscars.
Right.
Great reference, Steve.
So,
They're expecting the nod based solely on, we feel this theme is important, and that's how, mm-hmm. why it should get the nod.
Yeah, well,
even
or
if it
that
doesn't,
it's provocative.
Yeah, even if it doesn't meet all the needs of what a great film should do. And I think what's fascinating, too, I mean, you look at a phenomenon like Fireproof and the effect that movie's had, and it's easy to watch it and say, okay, obviously this isn't going to get an Oscar nomination. The Kendricks brothers that we had on the show would be the first to tell you, yeah, this wasn't made to get an Oscar nomination. But every week we see these stories of these lives that are turned upside down. And yes, as important it is to be culturally relevant and go watch a lot of these movies, a lot of those movies aren't having the ripple effects on the things that we care about as much as movies like Fireproof that are restoring marriages and breaking people from porn addictions. And you know, not to say a movie's got to do that, but I just think it's something we can honor and recognize it, even if it doesn't get all the Oscar accolades.
Yeah, the Kendrick brothers sort of have their own Bollywood, don't they?
Yeah.
You know, maybe it's Hollywood. Or something. You know,
or Albany,
but it is sort
of
this sub culture. I don't know. Bollywood isn't subculture, but it's different than Hollywood. It's sort of a
like
its
a
own
niche.
Brand. It's a niche, yeah. Because you're right, Fireproof was, you know, the production quality was lacking in a lot of ways, but, you know, it was definitely worthwhile.
Well, and, you know, another category that keeps emerging, every year they ask, now, when is it going to be the year that an animated movie doesn't just get nominated for the best animated movie, but for best overall movie? Because some people were arguing that, you know, Wall-E broke enough ground that it easily could have been nominated for best movie, even though, you know, we typically just cordon that off. Now, Mott disagrees. Mott and I had different impressions of that film. But I wouldn't be surprised if in a couple of years an animated movie is able to be vaulted up and voted on as Best Picture, even though it's not your traditional film.
What was up for Best Picture in the last few years that was an animated film? There was one that was.
Oh, it was? That actually...
Yeah, that was nominated.
Best Picture category.
Gee, I don't know.
Best Picture. We'll have
was
to find
Was it
Ratatouille
that out. Last year?
Yeah, I didn't know it actually made it to Best Picture. There were some
it,
other
I say
categories
it was like 3 or 4 years
it's gotten into. But anyway.
Was Finding Nemo ever nominated? I don't know. I just love it.
In
love
Best
Finding
Animation.
Nemo. I think it should be nominated this year in a comeback. Comeback role.
Nice.
Yeah, exactly.
Kung Fu Panda was better than Wall-E. I'll just go ahead and say that.
Well, because
Kung
it dealt
Fu
with
Panda
more universal themes that we all... No, it was funny, though.
Well, I think in a discussion of the Oscars, we neglect talking about what really casts a true vote, and that is the box office and what actually people go see. Because we know that, you know, films don't get made unless there's some chance of success generally at it. And you see that with franchises, how, you know, they'll start a franchise and if one tanks, I mean, it's like they've got all these Ernst & Young professionals on it, you know, tracking meticulously what the earnings are and if they can make another one based on that. So given the fact that we're all just ignorant and culturally illiterate, yes, and didn't see anything for the Oscars, mm-hmm, this year, until we go into the deeper categories, like we talked about Kung Fu Panda and some of the other things that are up for animated and for, there are a couple of the documentary things that I saw, but what did we see in 08?
Well, I enjoyed the John Adams miniseries on HBO because it wasn't something that made it to the theater, but powerful, well-done story built around David McCullough's book on John Adams. HBO does a lot of great work. Tom Hanks was a producer that came in and just really captured the grit and messiness, but also courage of John Adams as a founding father. And that was, once again, an example of not necessarily running to the theater, but something for home consumption. That was an excellent film this year.
I didn't watch a lot of movies this year. I'm usually a movie goer, but I would, every time I wanted to go see a movie, I'd look online and be like, huh, I don't want to see any of those. So I saw WALL-E and Kung Fu Panda. I like the animated stuff. And
yeah, well, I went to the theater a few times, and like I mentioned before, Batman, Prince Caspian, and Fireproof. And we rented WALL-E, Kung Fu Panda, and Indiana Jones, which was bad in my opinion.
Mm. And Iron Man, did you rent Iron Man?
You know, I saw Iron Man. I can't remember how or where.
I saw it in the Dollar Theater with my parents.
I think I saw it on a plane. I was on a trip. Mm.
But I liked Iron Man.
Yeah, and that was pretty good.
Yeah,
but it's a good example of the popcorn movie that's not going to get an Oscar nominee, but it keeps an audience on the edge of their seats.
But a show, it's not a movie, but it's something that came on PBS last year in 2008, was the Jane Austen series that we really enjoyed.
Oh, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that happening. And then there was Expelled and Fireproof. We had both of those this year, and we've talked about those a lot on the show. And obviously those maybe wouldn't come under the blockbuster category, but ones.
And don't forget Beverly Hills Chihuahua.
Beverly Hills Chihuahua was there, and any of the Tyler Perry ones, which there's another one coming out now. So when I passed by it in the theater the other night, when I went to see Confessions of a Shopaholic, I was like, can't wait for it to come out. I forget what it's called. Medea, something about, yeah, I forget what it is. Medea Goes to Jail, I think it is. Whoa, can't wait to see it. So, anyway, good times. I'll always provide the more astute references to films here, as we can all see. Well, as always, you can get info on movies from people who have actually seen them and know something about them at pluggedinonline.com. And that team there is very meticulous in reviewing films, not only for their content, but also just putting a shout out as to kind of what goes on behind the scenes and why they are or are not worthy of our time based on a lot of different criteria. So you can check them out there.
Feels just like I'm waiting in line behind the guy who likes to talk to the cashier. I wish he'd leave, I wish he'd go home, or be somewhere else. Something in the way, it's a pain, just like the day the train drops the gate and I'm late. I wanna leave, I wanna go home, or be stuck somewhere else. But I'm standing still, I'm waiting on you, 'cause I cannot move until you do. Yeah. It's like a traffic bottleneck when someone wrecks, my car gets stuck, it's just my luck. What the heck, I wanna leave, I wanna go home, or be stuck somewhere else. But I'm standing still, till you do.
For this week's culture segment, I have with me via ISDN from another part of the country, Dr. Jay Richards. He is with the Acton Institute out of Grand Rapids, Michigan. And the Acton Institute, for those of you who don't know, their goal is to marry Judeo-Christian truths with free market principles. And Jay, welcome to the segment.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
Good. Good to have you. He is actually a research fellow and then the director of Acton Media at the Acton Institute. And you guys have quite a varied, I guess, table of things that you deal with there. Issues related to the culture, related to obviously things that are happening in the news. You guys weigh in on things that are happening in the culture as well as in, I guess, trends in family and society.
Yeah.
Pretty fascinating.
Yeah, we do. I mean, yeah, anything that involves the integration of what we call markets and morality. Is the subject of our discussion, and especially in the last few years, our work ranges from the very academic, in terms of an academic journal, all the way out to a much more popular level, visual media and DVD-based curricula and stuff like that.
Okay. Well, we're going to talk in the next few minutes here just a little bit about what you got, something you guys have called the Effective Stewardship Curriculum. And I do want to say before we get started that you have written an article for us that we are releasing simultaneously with this interview for folks who go to boundless.org. It's an article on environmental stewardship, and they'll be able to read more about that issue specifically. That's kind of a part of the larger whole here. So getting back to the curriculum in general, what you guys have developed, give us a little overview, Jay, of what that is.
Sure. It's basically a five-part DVD-based curriculum on the topic of stewardship. One of the five lessons is environmental stewardship. But we had noticed that in churches and small groups, Sunday school lessons and churchwide campaigns, there's a lot of talk about this idea of stewardship. But a lot of Christians, when you hear a stewardship Sunday, it's sort of become a euphemism for fundraising. And so the pastor once a year has to talk about stewardship, usually in the fall. And it really doesn't have anything to do with anything in particular, except, well, it's time to pledge our giving for the next year. But if you actually look at scripture, stewardship is a really, really important idea. And it basically refers to everything that God has given us responsibility over. So for instance, God creates man and woman and puts them in a garden and then commands them to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over it. Now, dominion doesn't mean to destroy and dominate. It means to reign over the earth, to have responsibility over it as responsible stewards. And so we realize that really applies to everything in life. Our stewardly responsibility applies to absolutely everything. And that's what we wanted to do in this curriculum, is at least apply this idea of stewardship to five overarching areas. And so in the first lesson, we focus on the stewardship of our talents, those things that God gives to us each uniquely, our unique callings that God expects us to develop. And then the second lesson is on environmental stewardship, which is probably the most fashionable subject at the moment. Everybody's talking about environmental stewardship, and biblically, we're called to be stewards of the environment God has given us. But that also means if we're going to be good stewards, that we have to think clearly about the issue and not just accept whatever fashionable idea happens to be current. The third lesson deals with stewardship of our fellow human beings, in particular those less fortunate than us. We are called to be our brother's keeper. But again, we have to think clearly about how to help those in need, that is to help those impoverished, because there are a lot of policies that we could advocate that we might think would help the poor that actually harm them. The fourth lesson is the stewardship of what we call our cultural or civil institutions, the church, the state, the family in particular, all those institutions that aren't in the economic sphere, the political sphere, that God gives us responsibility over. And then finally, the fifth lesson is our finances and our giving, which is usually what the subject of stewardship is about. We put it at the end really just to mark the fact that stewardship involves everything we have responsibility over, our finances certainly, but a whole lot more than that.
Okay. So in going through those five things, were you reading that list? I think it's easy. I just sat there and was overwhelmed. I think to myself, obviously, I'm failing in about 4.5 out of 5 of those areas. So how would you counsel folks who are listening here on just how to get their hands around something like that? Where could they practically begin in any one of those areas?
Well, I mean, certainly when it comes to environmental stewardship, I mean, there's easy things we can do, and it's easy to become overwhelmed with the choices. I mean, we're told that we have too large of a carbon footprint, that we shouldn't fly in airplanes, or we should drive smaller cars. things like that. In reality, to be good environmental stewards, it's the easy stuff we can do something about that we ought to be focusing on. We should work hard to be less wasteful. We should focus on those things in our near environs. Don't focus on big global issues. Focus on things nearby where we can be less wasteful than perhaps we have been. That involves good stewardship. When we're talking about stewardship of our fellow human beings, don't think about how am I going to solve world poverty. Think about somebody you know in your community that you can directly help that's less fortunate than you. You're much more likely to be effective and you're much more likely to practice what we call effective compassion if you're dealing with somebody directly than just writing a check or becoming part of some global campaign. So most often, effective stewardship involves something much nearer to home than is imagined. And so it can be overwhelming. And frankly, that's why in this stewardship series, we chopped this up into 20-minute lessons so that it's a simple one-hour lesson in total. You have a 20-minute video component with a study guide that almost anyone could lead so that in 5 weeks with one-hour lessons, you can at least begin to broach the subject.
Mm-hmm. Now, getting back to just give us a quick explanation, too, of the cultural institutions. What's a tangible way of applying that?
Well, for instance, I mean, our families, which is something that many of us as Christians, of course, recognize. That's something that we're directly responsible for. But we very frequently, unfortunately, in the last 30 or 40 years have been all too willing to delegate a responsibility that is should be the proper responsibility of our family, but to delegate it to the state. So something like education. It's appropriate, if we do it thoughtfully, that we might delegate our responsibility as parents to a public school. We're essentially delegating that responsibility to the state. Nevertheless, we're delegating what is our primary responsibility. It is primarily the parents' responsibility to teach their children. It's not the state's primary responsibility to do that. It's easy to forget that so that we imagine that it was from time immemorial the responsibility of the state or the government to educate children, when in fact, at best, that is a delegated authority. And at any time in which the state ceases to do that effectively or appropriately, we can return that responsibility to ourselves. And that's something that I think parents should, as Christians, be constantly reconsidering.
Mm-hmm. Is there a way specifically you think that someone who's single and maybe in their 20s or 30s could begin applying that even now?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the truth of the matter is the lifestyle that we choose when we're in our 20s determines if we're planning on getting married and having children. It begins to shape that early on. I mean, we can decide to live within our means or below our means. If we decide early on that we're going to live beyond our means, it drastically limits the options that we can have once we get married and have children. So it's much more difficult, for instance, if we're living beyond our means, for one of the parents to stay home. We end up with automatically having to have two parents both in the workplace full time, and that obviously limits the educational opportunities that we can have. And so one of the very first things we can do, the second we're out of college, even if we're unmarried and single and have no children, is to begin practicing working below our means, which is a financial discipline, but it's also a moral and a spiritual discipline, which will allow us greater opportunities to exercise our stewardship over our future families, even though it might be 10 or 15 years in the future.
Okay. Let's just get back a little bit to the environmental stewardship again. What would you say? We get quite a few discussions going on our blog, The Line, related to this issue, mm-hmm. and they're very passionate, I would say, discussions kind of on both sides of this issue that come forward.
Sure.
What would you say is the best way for Christians to engage in a dialogue on this issue, and one that kind of gives us a place at the table without being super reactionary and really gives us an intelligent way of, you know, engaging in this discourse?
Well, I would say it's really important just to make clear distinctions when you're talking about environmental stewardship, and to distinguish what I would call non-negotiable theological principles from prudential judgments that you might make about a particular policy. A non-negotiable principle would be the idea that we are called to be stewards, that we have a rock-solid biblical foundation for the idea that we are responsible for the world that God has given us. Remember, God put Adam in a garden and told him to till and to keep it. The created order God declared was good and very good once he had created human beings to be a part of it. So biblically, we have every justification for being stewards. That, on the other hand, doesn't tell us what we should do about any particular environmental policy. For instance, to decide what to do, if anything, about global warming, we have to know a whole lot about climate science and economics and public policy to be able to make an informed judgment. And so I think the first thing every Christian ought to do is distinguish between a commitment to environmental stewardship on the one hand and the specifics of any particular policy on the other. Because global warming in particular is fraught with complicated and controversial details that you can't answer simply on the basis of a theological principle alone. Global warming, particularly, you have to ask, well, okay, there's this scientific question, is the globe warming? Is the Earth getting warmer over time? If it is warming, are we the cause of it? If we're the cause of it, is it a bad thing overall that the Earth is warming? And if we are causing it and it's happening and it's a bad thing, would any particular policy make any difference in the first place? All of those are separate questions, and they all have to be answered before you can get to any particular policy, any particular response to global warming. And so while I think there's a theological principle that all Christians should agree on, there's not going to be one uniquely Christian answer to a question on a public policy position. The best we can do is try to separate the controversial issues so that we treat them one at a time.
Mm-hmm. And do you think most of the controversy currently is centered around the science, or is it more of a passionate kind of lifestyle issue, the REI members versus the Christian conservatives who are each arguing from the heart and from their own experience?
Well, I do think that at least a lot of the public debate really is in some ways a clash over worldviews, because if you look at the environmental debate, at least as it plays itself out in the popular press, there is a disagreement about the role of human beings in the created order. Some people believe that we're God's crowning achievement in the creation, and other people view human beings as a sort of cancer or parasite on the created order. It's as if the Earth would be a lot better off if there were no human beings. So there is that, frankly, theological debate, but there's also serious scientific debate about the role of carbon dioxide in the warming of the Earth's atmosphere. There's real debate among scientists about that, even if you don't learn that from the cover of Newsweek. And so I think there's both worldview issues at stake in the debate and legitimate scientific issues in debate.
Hmm. Okay. So if you had a few minutes to sit down with Al Gore and Prince Charles and some of these other dudes, what do you think? What is the argument? What would you put forward, in 5 minutes to attempt to enlighten them a little bit on this, on your part of the issue?
Well, I would have them focus on the fact that we don't know directly when we're dealing with global warming whether carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is causing the warming. All we've got is computer models in which we plug in certain assumptions and it leads to certain results. But we don't have a direct sort of experimental evidence to establish the claim that human contributions to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is causing the warming. And just ask for a little bit of humility because of the nature of the subject. We're dealing with computer models that come to conclusions based on the assumptions that are plugged into the models. And so by the very nature of the subject, the best we're going to have is kind of speculative conclusions. We can't have absolute certainty on something like this. And so it's quite perplexing when we get these pronouncements of absolute certainty about things that are supposedly going to happen 50 years from now based on speculative computer models. And then I would certainly try to discuss very tangibly the effects of certain public policies like restricting the output of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, because everyone agrees on all sides that trying to artificially restrict carbon dioxide output would increase the cost of energy significantly. And when you increase the cost of energy, you affect the poor most of all, because they can at least afford increases in the cost of energy. And I don't think that's anything that anybody wants to have happen, whether you're Al Gore or anyone, because the poor will be those people who will be the most detrimentally affected by any change in energy policy.
Okay. All right. So last question. Looking at these five areas that we talked about, talents, environmental, fellow humans, cultural institutions, and then finances, wouldn't you think, Jay, that Christians of all people should be the best stewards in all of these areas? And why are we just so lame? Like, why can't we get it together? Why are we having to have this discussion and having to encourage Christians to look at stewardship?
Well, it is a little depressing. I mean, you'd assume that, you know, if we ourselves are believing Christians and are sanctified by the Holy Spirit and are going through the process of sanctification, that we'd be doing this better than anyone else. But the hard reality is that we are also a part of the culture and are affected by all the institutions of culture. And so if you look at any of the cultural indicators, Christians are more or less the same as everybody around us. Now, if you look at polls, the more devout a person is, the more they worship and are serious about their Christian faith, the better they are on these things. But many of us as Christians view our Christianity basically as a saving event. Christ died and saved me from my sins, but we don't think about our Christian faith as a worldview that has implications for every aspect of our life that requires hard thinking in order to work out the implications of the faith that then has to be put into action. And it's that next step, the sort of sanctification of the mind that I think we as Christians really need to take seriously.
Hmm. Well, those are good thoughts. Thanks so much for being with us, Jay. We have had, this has been a discussion with Jay Richards. Again, he's research fellow and director of Acton Media at the Acton Institute in Grand Rapids, Michigan. You can find out more about the Acton Institute at actonacton.org. And again, that article by Jay is going to be on boundless.org, or it is now. So make sure you check that out for more of a comprehensive discussion on the environmental piece as far as stewardship is concerned. So we'll make sure that you stay in touch with us, Jay. Any other developments you have, more research that you do, we want to be in the know, so keep us in the loop.
Terrific. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Feel like a bird tied to a tether. Not quite how it's meant to be. Looking around at all these feathers. I don't even need. Tonight I think that something happened when I decided to finally try. And maybe to you it looked like jumping. I think I touched the sky. 'Cause I almost flew today. Yeah, I almost flew today. There's not much of a tale to tell. 'Cause after all, I mostly fell. But I sometimes life is right for living. Seems like I'm barely getting by. And this hard ground is not forgiving. Someday I will learn to fly. Fly, I know, 'cause I almost flew today. Yeah, I almost flew today. Oh, there's not much of a tale to tell. 'Cause after all, I mostly fell, but I
as we open up this week's inbox, I'm in the studio with Steve Waters. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Lisa.
Hey. And we're going to answer a question from Samuel today. So, Steve, here we go. Samuel says, I'm a single 20-something looking to get married and start a family. I'm well-employed, making a decent income so that my future spouse doesn't need to work. Many of the young Christian women I meet are very career-focused. How important is a young woman's willingness to give up her career for family a factor in trying to find a wife? Is this something I should try to assess pretty early in the relationship or wait until the relationship develops? Along the same lines, is it healthy to think about starting a family as a factor in looking for a spouse or to mainly focus on just getting married first?
This is a great question, Samuel. I was reading recently that people don't get married to have kids anymore, that it's kind of later on their list of reasons they get married. They get married because they like each other's companionship. They want to have intimacy together and life adventures and all that. But most couples end up coming back around at some point during the relationship and considering kids again. 70% of all marriages end up including kids. The thing that's happening more and more, though, in relationships is people are surprised to find out how the person they married actually feels about kids because they have certain assumptions during the dating period of how they feel like this person views kids based on their conversations. In another day, people would spend all kinds of time during the dating time saying, so how many kids do you want? Do you think the kids would look like me or you? And those conversations are getting a little more off to the side now. And so that is why people are caught off guard later when they find out either my spouse really wants kids in a way I never knew during the dating time, and now how are we going to fit that into our marriage? Or on the other hand, my spouse is adamant about not having kids, and I always assumed they were open to kids. So I appreciate his question about how important is that in the dating time, because it's very important. It's one of those things that maybe it seems minor, but proves to become so major of an issue later. Now, the whole question about someone who's career-minded and their openness to having kids is very important because I found out with Candace, she was very career-oriented, very driven, and we looked for a lot of creative ways that she could continue to pursue her career and use her gifts and talents and also to pursue being a mom. But what we found out is it is very difficult to live the life of the full-throttled career and live like the person who doesn't have kids while you actually try to start your family, because the two are really in tension, and ultimately there are things you have to sacrifice. And so there are plenty of things that I've had to sacrifice as the husband and the father to be able to care for these kids. But Candace especially, as the one who provides a level of nurture and care that she's wired to provide that I just can't provide, has had to find plenty of areas where she sacrifices things and puts things on hold. And it is often hard to figure out early in the dating relationship just how much openness this person will have down the road to making those sacrifices. But it's something that's at least worth spending some time and conversation on instead of making any assumptions. I think that's the key thing. Mm-hmm. And I also appreciate his point about saying he's making a decent income so his future spouse doesn't need to work. I think one thing that can kind of catch guys off guard is that they can go into a relationship with someone who seems very career-minded and set up this double income lifestyle and a budget that depends on two of those incomes, and then be very surprised when this desire to have a baby comes on strong with a wife who then says, I want the option of being able to be a stay-at-home mom. And all of a sudden this guy realizes our whole world is turned upside down. But guys need to do everything they can to give their wife the option. The last thing you want is for a wife who says, I would love to be home with these kids, but our budget depends on me paying the light bill. I mean, ultimately, a man's got that responsibility to be the one who's providing. And the last thing you want is a situation where a wife has this incredible desire to be home with children, but then realizes that her income is absolutely necessary to pay the light bills, and she doesn't even have that option.
Okay, Steve and Candace are the authors of a new book called Start Your Family that is available in stores now or at your favorite online portal. But I know, Steve, you guys have often talked about how more and more young couples are delaying starting their family. And I have a friend who recently got married at 31, and she mm-hmm. I was quite surprised to hear her say, yeah, we're not looking at having kids for another 3 or 4 years. Yeah. What in the world?
A generation ago, the majority of people who were going to have kids had them within the first 3 to 5 years of marriage. And now it's only a minority of people who've had kids within the first 3 to 5 years of marriage. But when people were getting married back in their early 20s, that idea of waiting a few years, getting to know each other, getting some financial things taken care of was a lot more feasible because you weren't pushing up against fertility limitations. Now, if you get married at the average age, late 20s, early 30s, and then you say we're going to spend several years getting to know each other, paying off certain bills, then you don't realize your fertility is already beginning to wane. And by mid-30s, the decrease in fertility is beginning to rapidly accelerate. And then by 40, it's just plummeted. Mm-hmm. And so that's a nice goal in some ways, but it's just not realistic considering what's going on with fertility. And also just the energy you have to keep up with kids. Mm-hmm. And people like myself find out that having young kids when you're moving into late 30s and early 40s, it takes a lot of energy to keep up with kids, especially to give them that kind of daily romp that they need to get all their energy used and enjoy playing with mom and dad. It takes a lot out of an old man.
Okay, so what Steve is saying is just pop those kids out and just get it done.
No, I am saying that it's important to show stewardship, to be thoughtful, but to realize that you also have to be very intentional. And especially like Samuel's alluding to, be intentional about it going into the marriage to begin with.
Okay, that is spiritualizing it. We're still saying just pop the kids out and get it done. Okay. Well, again, the book is Start Your Family. Do check it out, and that could be maybe a future source of questions for us here at The Boundless Show. Write to us at editor@boundless.org. Questions for Steve or Candace or anyone else we decide to pull in at a moment's notice to address what you have. And certainly, you know, no question. Well, I'm not going to say that. No question's too difficult. Some, quite frankly, are. Obviously, if you want to ask us about the Oscars, don't do it because we don't know. So, but no, other questions we definitely want to field. So we always love hearing from you, and we will see you around next week. Until then, I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.